That's right, guys. We're here for the big cocks lovers.
Dude, speaking of big cocks, bro.
Mason.
All right, man.
Mason's big cocks.
Mason Cox, bro. Dude, all right, first of all.
Did you I remember watching that 60 Minutes thing I sent you a few minutes ago?
Okay, I haven't seen it, okay. But I've seen a lot about Mason
I want to hear what
Cox
you're going to say, but a couple highlights from it. He was high school teammates with Marcus Smart. He went to college at OSU and played a little bit for OSU. Now, AFL superstar Mason Cox. Tell me about him.
He's like 6'11", right? I mean, he's a big Cox.
He's
right?
a big Cox.
And I know a Cox personally. His name is Ian Cox.
Yeah,
and Ian Cox.
Did he have a brother named
Mason? No. He has a brother. Let's see.
Whatever. It's okay. We know Cox.
But Ian Cox was, I think he was 6'8". He's a big Cox.
Yeah.
Anyways, so I'm pretty excited to see Mason dominating. I mean, when I say dominating, I'm not being a jerk here, but he's one of the stars I would consider in the league right now. And what he's able to do at 32 years old at 6'11" is truly spectacular. And again, the 60-minute thing is just a tip of the iceberg, because it's something that we've said before. We believe that the AFL is something that can be switched from AFL to basketball. So if these young players in Australia are learning how to play AFL, it's something that relates to basketball. And then you see Mason Cox, who's 6'11", basketball player, go to the AFL and do some great things. And then you're saying, wait a second here. It is a sport that can go both ways. And I love things that go both ways. Don't laugh at me. I was almost able not to laugh.
I'm happy because a lot of people who listen to us have told us, check out Mason Cox. He's incredible. I didn't realize he was from Texas. I didn't realize that he was, you know, a Yank, as they call him. My daughter just asked me, what's a Yank? And I was like, well, it depends on who. She's like, well, somebody in a book said it. I was like, well, if they're in Europe or overseas, a Yank is anybody who is from the United States. So I dig it. I think it's great to see somebody who had that little exposure to a game go and learn it and be so effective. Obviously, there's a lot of skill that's required to learn, and it helped him that he played soccer when he was a kid. He played some basketball, but listening to Marcus Smart talk about the fact that people used to kind of like joke at him about him being wasted height because he didn't want to play basketball in high school. He was kind of like pushed into it in college, but he found his passion, and like millions of fans are in love with him now. And he's starting a trend, I think, hopefully, where we start seeing more Yanks go and play in Australia.
I love the AFL. I mean, to this day, there's very few sports that I get really into. And the AFL is one of those sports that, I don't know, like, I get excited about it. I get excited about the possibility, because we've seen what soccer players do when they're thrown into basketball. And they go play soccer at a young age, and then they decide to go play basketball at an older age. They got great footwork, great hands. Not so much great hands, but great footwork, right? So we see what that happens there. And then we see football players that play basketball. You know, we've seen baseball players that play basketball and the hand-eye coordination. So we've seen that switch over, but we've never really seen, like, big-time success from AFL. So when all of a sudden we're seeing Josh Giddey come through, and it's like, holy shit, Josh Giddey played, you know, footy for, you know, a few years growing up. And we saw that transition and what he's able to do with the open floor and the open court. Like, it's all goes in hand with the AFL. And it's powerful, because now you're seeing, like I said, a basketball player go play the AFL, and people are starting to say, hey, look, they correlate. They can be played, and they can utilize that vision, what they're doing.
Yeah.
And yes, size matters, especially that he's 6'11", but because he's playing basketball and there's so much of the same footwork and the aspect of what you're doing with your feet and the fake outs and different things like that, like, there's so much that's similar. It just correlates, and it's exciting.
It is exciting. I'm really pumped up about, you know, learning a little bit about it. Actually, I learned about it today. I'd seen on YouTube a few, you know, videos I should click on. 60 Minutes. I'm like, what is 60 Minutes doing a segment on Mason Cox? Maybe this is 60 Minutes Australia. It wasn't, and it was something that they took a little bit of time to explain a bit about the game and its evolution. There was a point in the 80s where ESPN couldn't afford NFL, NBA games, so they aired AFL games for years. I didn't realize that, and so kind of get a little bit of the history of the game, not much, but mostly kind of understanding how this guy came from, went from Texas, you know, graduated from college without knowing anything about the AFL and began a new life. Exciting stuff. And then, like you said, crossing it over with Josh Giddey, not just Josh Giddey, like the whole crop of elite AFLers who, or I don't know if they made, they didn't make it to like the top level. Ben Simmons, Patty Mills, like all these guys that were really, really good. And then there's like this correlation. It's not, you're not kicking the ball in basketball, but the element of like positioning and, you know, getting the ball, moving to the ball, moving to open spaces, you know,
throwing the ball to the open spaces where the runners are going. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the biggest thing we see Patty Mills and Ben Simmons and Josh Giddey just excel at. You know, like everybody else is like, whoa, how the fuck do they see that pass?
Well, you pass to the open area, right? Because you can have the ball bounce a couple of times and it's not a big deal in AFL. Whereas like the NBA, like you want to lead, but you don't want to, like people tend to pass to the open player, not to the open area. And that's a,
absolutely,
it's a nuanced difference, but it's significant when you see Josh passing players into open shots.
Yeah, and I think that's what's the best part about it is that when you have a player that understands spacing like Josh does, because again, it's the upbringing, it's the get to the open space, pass the ball so there's no, you know, competition of passing the ball. Like, I think that's when we see Josh get the ball outside or out of balance on the side or underneath the basket. We see him excel because what happens? He doesn't pick up the ball unless he sees something. He watches. Mm-hmm. He just watches. He has his hands on his hips or his hands behind him, but he doesn't actively go for the ball until he sees what he knows is going to work. And I think that's the greatest thing about it is that the guys, sometimes they even move around, right? So Josh doesn't touch the ball. The ref's ready to hand Josh the ball, ready to hand the Josh the ball.
A lot of times he'll stand where they can't hand him the ball. He'll be standing
inbound. Yeah, so he stands right inside balance. Right. Yeah, and he'll dictate where the guys are going. And a lot of time it's just like with the eyes. Like Josh is looking and then or he'll do something with his hands or, you know, it's a slight thing. But the thing that's powerful about it is that there's very few players that are able to be successful doing this because it takes years, Mark, years to be able to have a relationship with the player to be able to talk without verbal communication. And the crazy thing about this is that Josh hasn't had years with these guys. And that's the amazing part. Well, and that's why we keep coming back to it and saying, how good could Josh be? Well, we don't even know how good Josh could be. But the thing is that we do know is that Josh has an incredibly bright future as a future all-star, multi-all-star, and probably a top five MVP multiple times in his career in voting.
There you go.
And that's the thing about
Josh.
Fired
up again. You're going to get some people being like, no way. But hey.
Dude, listen, when you're an MVP type caliber player, right, you're going to put up crazy numbers like Josh is going to put up, right? And then on top of that is that if you're getting to the playoffs, it's not uncommon for you to have two guys that are finishing in the top five for MVP voting. We saw it with Russ and KD, you know, maybe top seven. But
Russ and
the
PG.
Point is that it's still getting votes in an MVP caliber type player. That's what I see in Josh. And I see that Josh is going to be able to be this bridge between the AFL and the NBA as it continues to evolve. Because the reality is that Josh is 6'9". Mm-hmm. Some people say he's 6'10", but he's 6'9 with a 7-foot wingspan, plays great defense. He's very physical. He gets downhill. Like when he matures into a 24-year-old young man, when I say that nobody's going to be able to stop him, like I truly mean that. I mean, like, think about it. He puts on, what, 10 more pounds over the next 4 years? Okay. Mm-hmm. He puts muscle that is huge. He's gonna become big. And then all of a sudden you get him going downhill again and again and again. And it doesn't matter who's guarding him. If it's a small forward, he's going to go around him. If it's a shooting guard, he's just going to go through them. You know, and it's the physical contact that he's going to do. And that it's going to be like, ah, what the crap. Because I do think that he can average 20-plus points a game. You know, I do think that he can average 14 assists a game. You know, I do think he can do something like that in multiple times in his career. And I think that's why I keep going back to it and saying with Josh is the key to the dynasty if we ever get one. Because we know that Shea is going to be good. We know J-Dub's going to be good. We know Chet's going to be good. But if Josh becomes an all-star, there's going to be nobody that's going to be able to fuck with our starting five. Nobody. Because we could have a year where our players are so good that we have four or even five guys in the All-Star game. And it's just because we're that good and the rest of the NBA is trying to catch up. I know it's crazy, guys. People are like, no way. There would never be five guys that are in the All-Star from one team. But that's where I kind of disagree.
Well, I mean,
because of the positional way.
If the Warriors were a little bit better at, you know, adding players, they had four
1 year,
right? With you count Wiggins, right? And then you come out and you're like, you know, that's a possibility depending on how successful the team is. It's an achievement award that comes from winning championships. It doesn't come from just winning games.
It doesn't come from anything else except for the respect that, you know what, you've got one of the best teams in the history of the decade, or this decade. Yeah. And because of that, we'll respect you guys.
So let me ask you about Giddey a little bit more. Like, you were saying, like, about it taking years for him to develop for players to develop the chemistry where they know where the other person is going to be. So, but we've heard a lot, like, Giddey learned how to play. Correct me, anybody who's listening, if I'm wrong here, but he learned how to play within Andrew Gaze's system. I know that's probably not originated with him, but the shuffle, I think, is what they call it, right? And it's a lot about backdoor movements, a lot about player movement, ball movement, side-to-side movement, keeping things going, which it seems like Coach Daigneault plays a closer version to the shuffle, or at least my understanding of what that is, than any other, like, recent NBA coach I can find. It's not like a true Princeton offense or something, like, where there's like a high post, backdoor cuts, and like all these different things, but it has a lot of movement that's similar, and they use all sorts of backdoor, double backdoor cuts and things like that might have been, you know, from those early teams. So how much do you think that plays into it? And overall, do you think Josh is still kind of playing that system and he has like even another level he can unleash?
Okay. Yes and yes and yes, yes. Okay. All right. So the way I explain Josh Giddey and how he processes things is the way I explain to young people when I'm teaching them how to rebound, right? The best rebounders I have ever met, the best coaches I have ever met, all right? They all said to me, the reason that you're an elite rebounder is something that's untaught to rebounders. And it was something at the time, you know, we're talking 90s and early 2000s, right? The time period, it was unheard of for high school kids to sit there and watch whether it was their own teammate's shot or the opposing team's shots. So what I would do is I would watch our players' shots all the time, okay? I would consistently watch every single release, where the ball was going. I would know where the ball was going by the release. Okay, I could guess it. Sometimes I was off, but I always gobbled up offensive rebounds like it was nobody's business. And on the other side, I would sit there for about 3 or 4 minutes because that's all I really needed to watch another team, and I would watch where the tendencies were to miss. So I'd put myself in those positions, and everybody's like, how the fuck did you always get those rebounds? Well, it's because I put myself in those positions by watching the players, right? Now, watching that and teaching rebounding and then trying to, you know, compare it to Josh, all right? What Josh does is he watches those players. He memorizes the routes that they go. He knows their tendencies. And then on defense, he watches the film of the tendencies of the players, and he knows where they're going and where their weaknesses are. He knows all of a sudden how to get the ball there, and he's standing on the sideline, or he has the ball at the top of the key, and he looks down the barrel, and he sees what he's been observing. He knows, boom, back door. He knows, boom, fade, wide open. Because he observes and takes in everything, man. Unlike anything I've ever seen before. It's truly elite and spectacular. And it's something that I look at and I keep on circling and saying, this is why this team is going to excel at such a great level.
You're talking about like processing power, right?
And high IQ processing power.
Right. And on top of that, like the ability to observe and have a LeBron James type memory of previous situations and where we need to go forward, what's going to happen next, and be able to see the play before it happens. And there's a couple players that we always bring up, and we say, yes, you can tell us why he's not that good. He's not this player. But we say Bird and Magic were two players who had like next-level processing ability in that they could see the plays happening before they did.
Big bodyguards, guard-ish,
right?
You know, that can play both guard and forward or center or whatever they needed to in the position that they were in.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, there's a few of them, guys.
I heard about a practice one time where the Lakers were preparing to play the Celtics in the finals, and they had Magic shift over to the scout team, to the second team, to be like, now you be Larry Bird, and we're going to practice our defense on you. And they said that he did a better Larry Bird impression than Larry Bird. And I think, like, it was his ability to shoot the ball was, I think it was just practice, but it was a lot more elite than I think a lot of people did. But he was Magic because, you know, he played downhill, he played in the fast break. He didn't just go out there and jack up a lot of shots. And neither did Larry Bird, but they just thought the game differently. They would lead players with their eyes. They would deceive the defense with their eyes. They would use a lot of different...
talk a lot of shit, talk a lot of trash.
Get in their heads.
Get in players' skin and under... You know, like, Josh does that, talking a lot of trash, when he goes to the officials. Mm-hmm. And he gets in the player's head without ever talking shit to the players. Mm-hmm. That's the thing I love about Josh, is that he uses the officials to talk shit to the players.
There you go.
And I've never seen it before. Like, I used to think Josh was whining, and then it all hit. Josh is just making the player look stupid. Because what he's saying is, like, he's doing this. It's obvious if you just look. You know, like, shit like that, where all of a sudden the player now has to defend himself. It's like, I don't do that shit. Come on, I don't do that. And you see it, guys. I'm serious. He gets in their skin really quickly by not addressing them.
You're right, bro. It's next level. And it just shows his gamesmanship and his commitment to...
understanding.
You know, winning...
love.
...the game, winning the possession, and then, you know, continuing to get experiences and accumulate, become a better player. Let's jump around a little bit. So last night we saw a couple of games.
Sure.
The Nuggets did what people expected them to do.
I did not want that to happen. I'm sorry. I was going the other way, bro.
We saw a little bit of drama. Two really small things. One where KD gets a technical for throwing an elbow at Jokic, which is very similar to the elbow that Jokic threw at the owner, Matt Ishbia. And the thing is, they both flop very similarly. So it was interesting to see, but that was, you know, whatever. Jokic didn't let up the huddle. What did you think about that? And what did you overall think about, I don't know, the hug out that Matt Ishbia had with Jokic before the game, where he gave him the ball, like, is it over now? Can we move forward? Is that it?
Like, well, first of all, that would have never happened if the Suns owner came out and said, you know, like, he should not get suspended. You know, it was just a heated moment. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that would have never happened. Because the second he stood up for Joker, then he was like, okay, you know what? Because let's just be honest. Joker was insulting him by calling him a fan.
You think
so? You know, like, if a man comes out with billions of dollars, comes up with billions of dollars to buy a team, and all of a sudden someone says, like, he's just a fan, that's a big fuck you moment.
Okay.
And what does Ishba do? He takes the high road. He should never get suspended. Whatever. And doesn't get suspended. So, of course, Joker owed him something. And doing that, it just, again, it reiterates what I was trying to tell everybody, is that he was going the wrong route. He shouldn't say that he was part of the team, not that he was a fan. Because making it a fan incident is a whole new situation. And that's what he was doing, essentially, is recognizing you're not just a fan. You're part of the game, and giving him the ball.
There you go.
Respect, bro.
All right, cool. How do you feel overall about... Okay, so if I'm thinking about this,
yeah,
more drama, game six coming up, the Suns need it. They should not let the game get out of hand, right? They should be able to win this game at home. If they lose control of the game, I would expect some antics. Now, say the Suns had PJ Tucker on their team, then I would really anticipate him going down with a fight.
Sure.
No PJ Tucker, maybe no more, like, big-time antics, but I feel like this could be moving toward a brawl. I really do. Not a full-blown brawl, but, you know, kind of wrestling match in center court.
Listen, Suns are going to win, all right?
Game 6.
Suns are going to win, okay? And then it's going to go to game 7, and that's where all hell could break loose. But the problem is that neither team is going to want to put themselves in jeopardy for the next series. We've seen it happen so many times, where one of the players throws a punch or throws an elbow and gets suspended. You know, I think of Zach Randolph and the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, game 6, at the end of the game, he, what, racks, punches Adams in the nuts.
I think you got him right here with the little face.
Oh, yeah. Punch in the face, whatever it was. But The point is that he gets suspended for game seven, we win. Do I think we could have won if he played game seven? I don't think so.
Really?
I think it would have been really, really hard. You know? And especially because we were a young team at that moment. So there's moments like that that I, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. You say Zach Randolph. It makes me think about how everybody for a while was comparing Julius Randle to Zach Randolph. And like they do have a similar style of game, but man,
yeah,
that's really insulting to Zach Randolph because he was a gamer.
Dude, he was a beast, bro. Yeah. He was like a bear. I mean, like
a grizzly bear.
He played. Yeah, like the way he attacked, the way that he like saw the disadvantage and just kept on going. Like Zach Randolph, I always looked at him as being like a player that if he was ever on a championship team would be known as one of those players. But the reality was is that he can never get to that championship caliber. And it's hard, man. It's really fucking hard to get to that championship caliber.
Yeah, for sure. Speaking of an attempt to make it there, we saw the Celtics get to the finals last year. And this year, they lost Game 5 at home to the Sixers. Now it gets crazy in Boston because they love firing their coaches. They had a huge disappointment with the Bruins. I don't pay attention to hockey that much, but I know they had a historic season and they didn't win at all. So that's not acceptable in Boston. Here we are. Joe Mazzullo is being scapegoated. I watched Jay Williams talk about it. I saw Keyshawn Johnson say, hey, he's learning on the job. People be patient. But we all know people aren't going to be patient in Boston. So I'm pretty sure they just gave him a contract, right? So there's no way they're getting rid of him. But like
they'll bring in a good assistant coach, an older assistant coach that's won it before.
He's lacking.
There's plenty of them.
End of game execution. And then his answers to the media about, you know, were the Celtics, like, did they want it enough? Were they working hard enough? Were they, you know, did they deserve the win? Basically, he was like, almost like they wanted it too much, and that's why it didn't work. I've seen that before, but, man, the Celtics didn't look like a team who wanted it too much. They looked like a team that didn't know how their bread got buttered at the end of the game.
We see it every year, bro. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do. We see it every year where a team just hits a wall. You know, sometimes that wall is the NBA Finals. And sometimes because they went to the NBA Finals, that wall is much earlier than they wanted to. I mean, we can talk about the team that won it this last year.
The Warriors.
Right? Okay, we can talk about the team before that actually got their ass handed to them, the Milwaukee Bucks. You know what I'm saying? Like, we can go down this road like championship caliber teams get their asses handed to them once in a while. And it just is the way it is. I mean, I don't know, man. I look at it and I can't help but wonder, some of these teams just made some really big moves as far as players go that shouldn't have been made. And I look at it and I say, I think it's one of those things where, yes, you can blame your brand new ass baby coach, or you can get to the reality of it and recognize that it's the front office that needs to get some shit together.
Because you should have never given
this job to a young ass player with no seasoned veteran coach in his back pocket to help him through these moments. Because this was a complete fuck up by the management of the Celtics, man.
If they want to get rid of him, the only way I think they could get rid of him would be bring Brad Stevens back to the bench.
Dude, I don't think Brad Stevens wants that, man.
I know he doesn't want it, but sometimes you got to.
Pat Riley didn't want it when he fired Stan Van. Yes, that's the thing, though. If he came back, Brad Stevens came back and did that whole management, you know, double seat for 1 year. Mm-hmm. To help Mazzullo, then yeah.
That wouldn't be called helping Mazzullo. That would be helping Mazzullo find a new job.
Well, but we saw what happened with Eric Spoelstra, too, with Pat Riley.
Yeah, well,
he took over the team, couldn't win.
Stan Van Gundy was the winner. He's the one who was coaching. Pat Riley came back, took the job and then passed it to Spoelstra. He didn't. He took it from Van Gundy.
I thought Spoelstra had it for 1 year, and then Shaq and they couldn't get it done, so he came back. I could be wrong.
It was Stan, bro. It was Stan who got royally
fucked. Blame it on Stan. I see what you're saying.
Stan got royally fucked, and then Pat Riley was like, I can't do that again. And look, Stan Van Gundy's forgiven him, it seems like, because he doesn't seem bitter about it, but like those were his championships. I guess what they won, one with Shaq
and Wade.
And Dwayne Wade. So, I mean, but if he had done that one, then maybe he gets those LeBron, D Wade, Chris Bosh championships too, because they probably would have stuck with him as the coach. So really, Pat Riley, you know, he fucked over two Van Gundys, one by leaving the Knicks and one by taking Miami back over. So, hey, they both work for TV now, so that's fine. Fine by them.
But I got it. Like, with that being said, working for TV, I feel like, is coach money with better schedule? You know, like, these guys are making $5-7 million a year by being analysts, you know, on television. And, bro,
it's good money.
Like, it's good money. And I think it has probably way better hours than having to go to 82 basketball games and 100 and something practices. And
dude, I met this guy, Billy Cunningham. He was a MVP back in the day. And he made enough money because he took part ownership of an ABL team. And he left the NBA after he won MVP championship. Went to the ABL, part owner. Then the ABL gets bought out by the NBL. So then he's a part owner of the NBA team. And he gets tens of millions. So he was telling me that ABC every year recruits him. This was a decade ago, but recruits him to do their games. And I was like, well, why don't you do it? I mean, he said, well, I don't like going to the West Coast a few times a year. So he basically turned down that $6-7 million a year job. But he had two championships, one where he was coaching Moses Malone and Julius Erving, Dr. J for the Sixers and stuff. So one as a player. Elite guy, 76ers history, North Carolina, Tar Heel alumni, one of the 50 greatest in NBA history, and doesn't need to work anymore. And I look at the Van Gundys and I'm like, man, they're working hard. You know who's not going to have to work for very long, bro? J.J. Redick. J.J. Redick has turned himself – he's everywhere. It's like – you know what he's like?
It's impressive.
He's like the Nick Cannon of the NBA now. You know, like, Nick Cannon's like the host of every fucking show that you actually never watch, and you're like, all right, I'm never watching it. Fuck.
Why am I watching Nick Cannon?
Well, J.J. Redick is like everywhere on YouTube. He's everywhere on ESPN, and now he's showing up and he's
Twitter,
doing the games.
TikTok.
I know. It's like you can't escape him. And that's fine. I grew up as a Redick fan.
Oh, yeah. Duke, man, I love the way watching Redick dominate.
He got so much visceral hate from everybody, and he fed off of it. But like, and by the way, I like him a little bit more now that he's an announcer, because I like hearing how his brain works, but it's like he's everywhere. He's like the Ryan Seacrest of everything,
man. I love it, dude. I like him. I think that the way that he explains things, and again, he doesn't stand for stupid players. I like that. But he does have that complete player positivity side.
Right.
That's what we're all about. And I think that's the thing about what's missing in a lot of the media is even when players, ex-players become part of the media, I feel like sometimes they throw their fellow teammates and stuff like that under the bus to get their jobs. I love the fact that JJ is like, fuck that shit. You know, like, this is all about the positive side of stuff. Yeah, if somebody wants to bring a gun to a nightclub, I'm going to throw them out under the table for that shit because that's stupid.
Right.
That should never happen. But I love JJ. I love the fact that it's players, players, players. And he's always trying to promote the positive side of these guys. And that's perfect.
Absolutely. And there was a lot of conversation around Giannis and, you know, him saying, hey, there's no failures in professional sports and stuff like that. And I really appreciated, like, former players who have podcasts or platforms who took time to really elaborate on what Giannis was saying and not just give it, like, a headline-type treatment. Just be like,
sure.
Like, you compete for 82-plus games every season, right? You're gone on the road most of the year. You don't get to see your family that much. You don't get to hang out with your friends that much and everything. And then it's over, and everybody's like, failure. And it's like, is it? Was it? I don't know. It's debatable. So what's up?
Well,
what's up?
I want to say this. Josh loves Oklahoma City. We love Oklahoma, or we love Josh too.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the reasons that Josh is going to love Oklahoma City, and what I truly believe is that Josh is going to get a max contract throughout his career. He might even get two, meaning the fact that he could end up making someplace close to $250 million in his career. So for me, I truly say this. I hope he makes that money in Oklahoma City. I really hope he makes that money in Oklahoma City, because he's one of those players that I look at and I want to see the longevity of him. I do think that he could end up making $25 million plus a year for an average of 10 years. And I think that's something that's crazy if you think about it.
Yeah, and if you think about back when we were listening to Chet's family being talked to in the media, the Minnesota media, right before the draft, like, his parents did a really long interview. It was like 45 minutes, I think, and it was really insightful. And one of the things Chet's dad said was just that, like, it's not the first contract in the NBA. The first contract is good money, but it's that second contract. If you reach that one at a max level, it's crazy how much money that is and how long it can affect your life positively.
Not just your life, but, like, the generational.
Right. Generational wealth comes
from
that.
Take care of it.
Right. And I think that's one thing that was really important to the Holmgren family, was that the team that picked him was thinking not just about, like, getting the most out of him when he was young and then, you know,
rushing him back from anything that would happen to him,
which turned out to be a little prophetic there. And I think when you see that and you're like, okay, and then you think Josh Giddey, his family, his countrymen, his supporters that loved him before we loved him in Oklahoma City, they must feel very good that Oklahoma City is the right place for Josh to have the longest, healthiest, best career he could possibly have. And anybody who questions it, just go watch. Go watch any playoff game right now. And it's filled up with former Thunder players. Jeff Green, Kevin Durant, Cameron Payne. Where's Chris Paul, bro? What happened to Chris Paul? Let me ask you, bro. Is this his legacy? I'm sorry to change the subject so drastically, but I'm just like, all of a sudden I'm sitting here being like, Chris Paul, like, playoff
dude,
comes.
He's going to be back game six.
Playoffs
he's
come.
Back next game.
Where is he? He's on the bench every single year. He can't make deep playoff runs. Is that his legacy?
Dude, this is why the Oklahoma City Thunder laid the groundwork of how to take care of Chris Paul for the Suns. And then you know what the Suns did? Because the only time that Chris Paul has been able to stay healthy into game seven of any game seven,
I know,
I feel like, is with the Thunder.
And he was, you know, and he was very healthy at the end.
And that was the thing, is that you have, like, that's
trash
why
trash load management if you want, but do you want the stars playing in the playoffs when everybody's watching or not?
To me, oh man, this is going to get me hyped, bro. Talking about our, people used to get so pissed, and I understand the whole concept of load management. I understand the whole idea that we want certain players playing at this certain time. But you know what I'm not willing to give up? Is a healthy team.
Yeah.
If you take care of the players and you play them between 50 and 75 games, depending on their age, depending on their structure of their bodies and their bone structures and all that other stuff, right? 75 to 55 games. I mean, you could go 70 to 50 if you want, whatever. But if you keep it in that range, you're going to have a consistently healthy team late in the playoffs. Okay? Like, that's what the Thunder have done. I look at this and I say, teams like the Suns, teams like, every fucking team out there that use their players so much, what's going to do is that the playoffs, you see teams that are shooting like what? Like 25% from three-point range, and like they're tired, they're not hitting free throws, right? When you're playing against a team that's well-rested in the playoffs, it's hard because they just keep coming at you, and you got to keep your seven games, your starting five out there, top seven guys out there. That's hard. That's why it's important for the Thunder to keep this rotation up, keep the guys healthy, keep them sifting in the bench and making sure that they rest of every 7-8 games to get a rest.
Especially specific games. You can circle them pretty,
yes.
Like they call them schedule losses, or, you know, you end up traveling the day after a home game, right? And then you're on the road the next day, like back-to-back, those types of ones, those are really tough. So I feel like those are, and that's the thing, bro. Like, I get this idea that, like, oh, well, we want to you know, we want to have the fans see whatever. They need to see all these games. That's great. And, you know, they can schedule, if it's a big national TV game, they can schedule a day off before if they really want to make these things happen. But in the end, there's nothing better than having, like you said, healthy teams. And why is it that Chris Paul's 1 year with the Thunder was seen as like an oasis amongst the desert? It was because teams that are player-centered, teams that use not just advanced analytics, but also advanced science to come up with a plan and understand the, okay, this is a season that's going to last 80, maybe 90 games. Say 90 games, yeah, if you're going to make it to the first round of the playoffs, right? So 90 games in, how do we make sure you're at your best? Now, at 90. Now, nobody else is thinking that. They're like, we want to be our best at 50 and then hold it. Well, guess what? Yeah. Chris Paul can't hold it being his best midway through the season and then make it all the way through the playoffs. We've seen that with the Hornets. I could go on and on and on.
But it's because the load management, man. You're killing one of the greatest point guards of all time. Like, this is what I've always hated about the NBA, is that when an NBA player is done, how many of them have you ever seen that have straight fingers? How many of you have ever seen that have knees that are good and backs that are good and necks that are good?
Without limping and stuff. Very
walks good. Without. You don't see it. Right. I mean, I guess with this, with any professional sports, but it's so hard on the body, and it's because they play 82 games in a season and all these practices and all this stuff, you know, in the off season. That's why it's important for the Thunder to look at it and say, listen, if Shea and Dort and all these guys are going to play in the national team, and they're going to play, what, 15 games in the national team or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
We need to make sure that we're the ones that are load management. And then on top of that, we call contact, you know, Canada and say, these are our requirements.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are what we do with the players. We would like you guys to do the same. And they will, because it's about making sure they stay, you know, connected through this all. That's what's important. Because if you can continue to do this and all of a sudden that 15 games because of their load management is down to 12 games, and then you take their, what, you know, 10 games they missed, 7 games they missed during the regular season, and now they are only playing 86 games right now, right? If they make the playoffs, that will shrink because you're not going to have them play on the national team right away.
Mm-hmm.
So that will shrink again, you know? So there's certain things that, to me, I'm looking at it, and I can't help but say, if we do things properly, we have an opportunity for this team to stay healthy through it all. And that's bigger than anything else that I can ever imagine and expect, because that's how, you know, dynasties are won, you know, like staying healthy and getting back and back and back to the same situation. It doesn't matter if you're the 4 seed or the 6 seed. Like, if you're a championship caliber team, even limping into the playoffs, you're dangerous as fuck. Nobody wants to touch that shit.
Yeah. Hey, Frank, I'm glad you showed up. You asked us a question yesterday, I think, about Bryce Sensabaugh and a few other players. I didn't get to all the guys, but I watched some highlights of Bryce, and I was really, really impressed with his game. Physicality, Ohio State. I think he's a 2-guard, but he's 6'6". He's got real, real strong body, and he can shoot lights out. I think he has a lot of James Harden in him. His age is good. I'm a big fan. So anybody else who has players you want me to check out, send it over. Frank, I'll be honest. If we got him at 12, I would be so stoked. Now,
man,
that would – when I watch him play, I can't see necessarily the player he would be in the NBA. I have trouble with that. But if Sam Presti was like, that's the guy, then I would know that, like, 5 years later, we're looking at a guy who has a potential to be an all-star. If he goes to the Hornets, I'd be like, 5 years later, he might not even be in the league. Like, I don't know. I go back and forth with him because he's 6'6", 235, I think. You got to be able to really move quickly in the league. He lacks a little bit of explosiveness, and he also lacks the ability, I think, to elevate over people because of his size. But with a body like that, you can get to your spots. You can do what you want to do. It's all about skill development. It's
developmental.
Yeah.
I mean, can you develop those skills? And I think you could. That's the biggest thing.
So, Salty.
I know Truman, by the way,
all right.
In Oklahoma.
Terman.
All right, yep, that's the right throw in. My bad, Frank.
All right, so Salty mentioned that Josh was intent on making the point that this roster with the Thunder is exceptionally tight, and
it is, man.
It is. You can tell, and the players the glue guys, talk about it.
There's, It's beautiful, bro. Yeah. It's been constructed amazingly by Sam Presti.
And it makes me think a little bit about something we've talked about more in the past, was like Sam Presti post-season press conference is talking about some of the books he's reading. He's really focusing in on books by producers, music producers, like the ability to like add different people to a room and end up with a different chemistry. It reminds me of when my kids were applying for college recently. They really wanted, you could tell that they're intent on having students get accepted who would add positive vibes to the campus, to the dorm room, to their dorm building, right? They wanted people who would interact with people, be a part of the situations, learn how to live in a life and not just be like isolated students. And I think Sam Presti, when he's like an admissions counselor, he's like, how will this person, you know, interact with this group? What will that bring out of him? And what will he bring out of the group? And that's what producers do a lot of times, right? Like, I'm sorry, that person can't be in the room when they're making music. Why not? Well, that person is paying too much attention to them and they're not doing their job, and that affects that person and everything. And they got like, look, this is how you have to do it. Sometimes you have to be a bouncer.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing that you have to look at. The bouncer is the key to holding it all together. And people call it glue guy, people call it this, people call it that. But the reality is that if you look at the people that are videotaping inside the locker room and giving you guys a glimpse of what it is, like, it's because it's fun. You know, J-Dub picking on J-Will, you know, like they have this, you know, way of going about that. It's just the swagger of love. And it's crazy because, again, when you get a bunch of young guys together with a young coach that's passionate, I mean, things like this are going to happen. It's beautiful.
So did you hear that thing about Jordan Poole post-game press conference in the locker room where he wouldn't – like, at first he wouldn't face the media? I'm not sure if he ever did face them. Yeah. But, like, that's what you have to kind of contrast it with. Like, you got to know what you're getting. Like, I'm sorry. Like, it's not Jordan Poole's fault that he got punched in the face. But, like, in the end, if somebody's, like, coming out and bringing the worst out of the other teammates, you got to, like, recognize that. They might be a good shooter, but in the end, like, are they – talking in a way that irritates people? Because let's face it, like when Klay shot that shot, like I think a minute left, they were down by one. It was a three right in front of Steve Kerr, and Kerr and Draymond were like, what the hell? Like, what the hell? That was a terrible shot. And they both were yelling at Klay. Like, it's not the first time Klay's been yelled at like that. It's not the first time that Draymond's treated Klay like shit. Or Steve Kerr's yelled at any of the guys for shooting a quick shot, rush shot, you know, out of the offensive flow. So it's about the character of the player in that moment.
Exactly.
And I don't know that Jordan Poole has what it takes to bounce back, because he's sitting there blaming the coach. He did it in the media. He said, my preparation doesn't change, my approach doesn't change, what changes my opportunity. So he blames it on the coach. And I'm like, you can't have that, right?
I mean, yeah, man. It's like, you know, I'm at college, you know, hanging out with my buddies, and I went to go take a dump and, you know, decided to you know, pull one off in the bathroom, right? The bathrooms were single guys, they're not double. Some dude walked in, and from that point on I was known as Jack Off Dave.
The wanker.
Wanker Dave, right? My point is, guys, is that shit happens, right? And I don't know, man. I can't look at what's gonna be the future with this team or anything else like that, but I do appreciate the structure of everything here.
Yeah, like Salty says, it's not a coincidence that the entire roster is humble and we don't have a Jordan Poole amongst the groups yet. Yeah, we'll see. Like, it's also people who evolve. They change. They get different voices in the ear, a new agent, a new friend, a new spouse, whatever. You don't need a Yoko Ono. Anyway, we'll move back, though. A second ago, Salty said, is 82 games too many? Yes, but there's no way out of it. So it's too many. But it's up to each team to figure out how to navigate it. They should figure out how to minimize the back-to-backs, but it's almost impossible. I think COVID helped a little bit with the travel schedule, but you see, even with it being helped, it's terrible. You owe it to your players. You owe it to your organization. Shit, even if you don't want to think about the players as people, like, think about them as investments. Like, you have to protect individuals. You have to protect their career. You have to protect their longevity. You can't risk short-term gains for like you can't risk the long term shit for short term gains. It's just we're in the spot where it is too many games, but the financial makeup of it is like the reason that these players get paid now contracts of $250 million, an amount that would buy a team 2 decades ago. I think I'm probably wrong, but I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
The Oklahoma City Thunder, weren't they purchased by like $386 million or something like that?
Right, and now...
I think it was... guys, don't quote me on that because I'm probably way off.
And now we're sitting here and like these players can get these contracts and it's about an economic model that includes every team going to these opposing arenas for 82 games. And on top of that, the TV money. Those two things are built off of this ridiculously extravagant schedule. But you know what? It's not new. Many other players have had to deal with it. And many other organizations have found ways to maximize players' careers, although it's the exception. And if you're going to study it, you might as well start with a team like the Spurs.
I mean, that's it, man. I don't know how to say it better than that right there, because that's what this team needs to be able to do. We've got 10 years, guys, and if we can accomplish even a championship in the 10 years, it's a success. But I think that we have more championships than one. And I want to be like clear with that is that that's with healthy players. That's with a healthy minded coach. And that's with an organization that isn't torn to shreds because some type of weird two teams are added to the NBA and you only can save six players per team type thing. Okay. Like that could just shred a team. But I don't think that's going to happen. So thus, I think the Oklahoma City Thunder will be okay.
Everything is gonna be all right, everybody.
Bam.
Hey, Dave, I know you got to get out of here. I appreciate everybody joining us. This was a fun one.
It was, man.
Last second, we had to come up with the wonkiest name we ever came up with. So we call this episode Big Cocks Lovers. I'm going to change that later. But for now, I know, I know you sickos are. The people who clicked on this, you sick fucks. You sick fucks. I know what you were looking for.
I love all of you for that. And by the way, the biggest cocks of all are the cocks that are named Mason.
Mason Cox. Man, like I said, guys, I'm going to post this right now, right before I end this. It's a little it's a thing by 60 Minutes on Mason Cox on YouTube here. And his incredible journey from Texas to Oklahoma State University. High school and college teammates of Marcus Smart goes on to become a international superstar in Australia. And we are all thankful to Mason Cox and Josh Giddey for beginning this revolution of Australian rules football, taking over the U.S. It starts here. It starts now. We love you guys. We will see you soon.
All hail the Giddey Coxes.
Giddey, 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 go.